Well, for those of you old enough or resilient enough to have lived through the 2008-2009 passage of Obamacare being rammed down the throats of Americans by progressives without a single Republican vote, you may remember one of the more charming episodes of that time when the Democratic Party essentially came out and said, don't let opportunities like Christmas and Thanksgiving pass without a chance to go and educate your racist, ignorant, stupid, misogynist, homophobic, Islamophobic parents, family, and other close relatives on the benefits of Obamacare. Take Thanksgiving. Take a moment at the Thanksgiving table. This is what they said to do, to enlighten them about the benefits of Obamacare. And I remember thinking, and you probably did too, what kind of person does something like that? I mean, what kind of killbot does something like that? Who shows up at a family gathering for people you see at best probably once a year, and often maybe not for the last several years, loved ones, families who you may disagree with on things, who views that as an opportunity to proselytize all of them into thinking exactly the way you do based on what your superiors have told you to think? Who does it? It was inconceivable to me. I couldn't connect to it. But nevertheless, there it was, and a lot of people did it. Now, for those of you who think that that kind of insanity is a thing of the past or just a one-off, we found this charming tweet today on Instapundit. Many of us are getting vaccinated and will be seeing extended family for the first time in a long time soon. I'm with you, Sarah Jane. It'll be good. Be good to get back and see people we haven't seen for a long time. Well, I'm sorry, there's more. There will be a desire to avoid hard conversations since you've missed them. Don't do it. Start preparing now to call out your racist relatives. There are no excuses. What a charming person. I'm sure she's just absolutely delightful to date. And I'm sure having her at the Thanksgiving table, no matter what your background is just a joy. Well, our mission here at BillWhittle.com, of course, is to follow the science wherever it may lead us. And as it turns out, we just saw a report about some actual science that was actually done on people like Sarah Jane Glynn. What percentage of progressives, especially young progressive women, do you think hold these kind of problematic opinions about interpersonal relations? Do you think it's 5%? Could it be 10%? I mean, 10% of a population with a serious, you know, emotional disorder is significant. Well, a Pew Research, as I said, has done a study on that, and they found that the percentage of young liberal women that exhibit clinical signs of mental illness is actually, thank God, it's not 10%. It's 50%. 50%. And Pew didn't just discover that. They discovered something else, conveniently enough, and that was, how does this compare to moderates and conservatives? Because if 50% of young progressive women have mental disorders, emotional disorders, and conservatives have 80%, well, really a point that we would particularly want to trumpet, is it? But let's take a look at the research and see what the science is telling us. And in order to get this, we're going to go to that bastion of conservative thought, the kind of, oh, I don't know, let's just call it the intellectual center of conservatism. I'm speaking, of course, about Evie magazine. Here's what Evie had to say. Over 50% of liberal white women under 30 have a mental health issue. Are we worried yet? Question mark by Elizabeth Condra. This is going to knock you to your knees, but it turns out, no, I don't think they're too worried yet. Here's what the article says. A 2020 Pew Research study reveals that over half of white liberal women have been diagnosed with a mental health condition at some point. Does this mean there's a correlation between progressive ideas and mental health? Let's just stop right there, and let's go to what the actual data from the Pew Research Center shows. Now, as you can see here, here are three different sets of bar graphs, and they're a little bit confusing, so I'll put a little box around them. The set on the left is white liberals. The set in the middle are white moderates, and the set to the right are white conservatives. And the question is, has a doctor or other health care provider ever told you that you have a mental health condition? And this is the percentage that says yes. Now, if you look at these three sets of data, you can see that when it comes to white liberal women, the number of respondents who said yes was 56.3%. If you look at white conservative women, you see the number is 27.3%, and moderates are a little higher at 28.4%. In other words, as you can see from this chart, white progressives are significantly more prone to be diagnosed with emotional problems than white moderates, and white moderates are significantly more prone to be diagnosed than white conservatives, although not by as much of an amount. So does this mean that that the people on the opposite side of the aisle from us are crazy? Is that what this science seems to be indicating? You know, I don't want to come out and say that. But if you can add, I draw your own conclusions on this one. Let's look at some of the explanations that's proffered for all of this in EV Magazine here. But what if what was once a cheap shot or personal insult has actually been found to bear scientific correlation between the individuals who hold progressive ideologies and an increased risk of mental illness? That's exactly what Pew Research has found. And all politics aside, the shocking diagnosis of over 50% of liberal women with some form of mental health medical diagnosis is a public health concern that no one seems to be discussing, let alone taking seriously. And when they say that no one seems to be discussing, let alone taking seriously, they're referring to the fact that the 50% of women who have been diagnosed with emotional problems aren't discussing it or taking it seriously. The rest of us have been discussing it and taking it seriously for quite a long time now. Let's continue. But biology and hormones aside, what about the choices we actively engage in, the behaviors we indulge, the beliefs and convictions we hold as more important than all the others? The people we spend our time with, the actions we devote our energy to, and the news we consume. Is that negatively impacting our mental health, or even more importantly, leading to medical diagnoses? And now we get to the heart of the argument, which is really the classic chicken and the egg argument. Does progressive politics make people nuts, or are crazy people drawn to progressive politics? And I'm kind of inclined to think it's the latter. You have to go back to that tweet we started just a little while ago. I mean, think about that. It starts off on an optimistic note. Well, at least I consider it to be an optimistic note. Not everybody's pleased about the ending of this COVID-19 restrictions, but I am. I can't wait to go and see family again. It's been so long. I can't wait to get together with old friends and family. But don't let that soften your ideological imperative to call all of them racist and misogynists and homophobes and all the rest of it. You have no excuses. Get out there and confront them. Now, that's not so much a political ideology to me as it is just not a very nice person, an unhappy person, a really unhappy person. I don't know. I was a very unhappy person for most of my life, too. It's probably a coincidence. That's when I was at my most liberal, although I was never what you would call a progressive. But generally, that's pretty much true. So which is it? Which is it? Let's dig a little deeper into the research. Dr. Lyle Rossiter, a board-certified psychiatrist who's treated mental disorders for over 30 years, agrees and adds that white liberalism thrives on supposedly championing workers, minorities, the little guy, women, and the unemployed, who they continuously see as wronged, cheated, oppressed, disenfranchised, exploited, and victimized with little to no agency of their own. A view that often mutates into the infantilizing and patronizing of certain groups within a narrative. The people responsible for these crimes? As Rossiter tells it, quote, poverty, disease, war, ignorance, unemployment, racial prejudice, ethnic and gender discrimination, modern technology, capitalism, globalization, and imperialism. In the radical liberal mind, this suffering is inflicted on the innocent by various predators and persecutors. Big business, big corporations, greedy capitalists, U.S. imperialists, the oppressors, the rich, the wealthy, the powerful, and the selfish. Let me clarify that last little bit for you here. That inherent in that worldview, that everybody out there, the poor, homosexuals, the dispossessed, on and on and on and on and on, none of them are real people. None of them are capable of making actions or decisions on their own. None of them are capable of resisting oppression on their own. None of them are capable of rising above repression on their own. None of them are capable of doing anything but continuing to suffer until some white liberal comes along to raise them up out of their misery. And who are the oppressors in this case? Well, let's see again. It's big business, big corporations, small distinction, greedy capitalists, U.S. imperialists, the oppressors, the rich, the wealthy, the powerful, and the selfish. So those people are oppressing the other people, and it's up to the white liberals to stand in the way and to prevent these helpless little lambs from being taken advantage of by these rapacious wolves. And to the degree that they're not successful in doing this, this leads them to be mentally unhappy and unstable. Okay. Now we get down to a brass tacks, because here's an article from April 12th by my good friend, I'm not above dropping names like this one, John Nolte. And John Nolte writes at Breitbart, and here's the headline, "Rural Trump voters already live in the safe, tolerant utopia leftists claim to want." And he's right. And we know this. That's why you're watching the show. We know that rural America, America, red America, is not a land of racists and oppressors and people who are just looking for every opportunity to keep, let's just say off the top of our head, black people down. On the contrary, they're filled with people who want to see everybody rise, want to see everybody succeed. And so what the dynamic is here is if you go into red state America, what you find is a country with no gun violence, very little crime, if any, very little, if any, racial intolerance, law and order, the ability to walk the streets at night in safety, that's red America. And if you take blue America out of red America in terms of statistics, the United States becomes essentially the safest place in the world. I covered this in one of my firewalls that I like very much called Number One with a Bullet, which we're linking to below. Number One with a Bullet has the actual statistics. If you take progressive America out of America, if you take the statistics from progressive America, you know, inner cities, out of America, then America is paradise. It is the safest, cleanest, most advanced, highly educated, kindest, most diverse country in the world. And now we get down to the root of the actual mental illness here. Because what's actually happening is people are driving themselves crazy by believing that a fictional enemy is creating a problem that only they can solve. But since the fictional enemy is, you know, fictional, there is no practical way to solve this problem, which is why again and 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 again, I think without exception, every time you hear about Nazi writing on a wall or anti-black graffiti on a college campus or somebody being beaten up and harassed by Trump supporters because they're gay or black, every single time, it is a progressive acting out of frustration because the enemy that they have pinned their entire mental ill philosophy on doesn't exist. And so they have to be created. That's what we're dealing with now. We're dealing with people who are barking mad, who have decided that Trump supporters and Republicans and conservatives are the problem when any walk into conservative America shows you precisely the opposite. This is where the diversity really is. This is where the racial harmony really is. This is where the opportunity really is. It's where the safety really is. It's where the friendliness really is. It's where the family really is. Red state America is the place you go to Thanksgiving. And if you have relatives who you disagree with, you decide not to talk about those things because we just kind of want to get along. And so when you have a philosophy that makes good people into the villains, these people drive themselves insane by trying to find the concrete examples of the villains doing villainous things. And when it doesn't happen, they have to invent evidence to prove their own theories to themselves. You know, there is a word to describe people like this, people with this condition. It's a word that has a very clearly defined meaning. It's a medical term, and it has been removed from the psychological lexicon, probably because the people who write the psychological lexicon realize that so many of they themselves suffer from this condition. You don't hear the word anymore, but it's pretty clear. And that word is neurotic. Neurotic. What is the definition of a neurotic person? Well, let's have a look. Wikipedia says that according to C. George Borey, professor emeritus at Shippensburg University, the symptoms of neurosis may involve anxiety, sadness or depression, anger, irritability, mental confusion, low sense of self-worth, etc. Behavioral symptoms such as phobic avoidance, vigilance, impulsive and compulsive acts, lethargy, etc., cognitive problems such as unpleasant or disturbing thoughts, repetition of thoughts and obsession, habitual fantasizing, negativity and cynicism, etc. Interpersonally, neurosis involves dependency, aggressiveness, perfectionism, schizoid isolation, socioculturally inappropriate behaviors, etc. In other words, neurotic people have personality deficiencies that they elevate into heroic qualities, and you heard some of them there. There are some very, very fine psychologists out there, and I ought to know because I've been to a few of them. But ultimately, when it's all said and done, the best cure for this kind of neurotic, obsessive behavior that the left increasingly exhibits would be to take them one by one and put them out into Red America for a couple months. Just take them away from the echo chamber. Take them away from the evidence of violence and lawlessness and hatred that they've generated in their own cities with Democratic politicians that go back for 100 years in most cases in major cities, something like that. Take them away from all of that. Take them out into the woods. Get them some fresh air, some homemade dinners. Sit around a table with a family. Talk about things other than politics. Realize that there are real people with real problems and good people out there who may disagree with you about certain things. Expose them to different opinions. And most of all, expose them to that kind of kindness and lack of judgment that you often find, usually find, in conservative families all across this country. If you were to do that, it probably wouldn't have any effect on these people at all.
We're going deep into the heart of femininity, and you will emerge from this knowing everything there is to know about the fairer sex. There will be no mysteries left to be revealed. You will be all-knowing, all-wise. Do not use this knowledge, my friends, for the power of evil. Use it for the power of good, I tell you. I beg of you. I beg of you. All right. Let's do it. Hi, it's Stefan Molyneux from Free Domain. It is the year of our Lord, 2021, Monday, April the 5th. And what can I say? It's all going to become clear. Everything is going to be understood. And there shall be no mysteries in the world anymore. So, at least with regards to women. In the best relationship ever since finding a good conservative, do you know which women have the very best sex life of all? It's white Protestant women. White married Protestant women have the very best sex life of all. Somebody says, married for a long time, working on the baby. All right. All right. Married but fight about the dumbest stuff. Life is good. All right. I seem to attract girls with mental problems or absent fathers. Well, you got to stay away from the leftists, right? I mean, you've seen the studies, right? That among younger leftist women, more than half of them have been told that by a medical professional that they have a mental health disorder. More than half. I mean, they were seriously nuts and incredibly dangerous. Or what you have to do is you have to ask a woman what she thought of the Kavanaugh hearings. And if she's like, serves them right, run! So... All right, so we ready to go? We ready to dive in? We ready to cook? I didn't circumcise either of my sons, so thank you for that. To be honest, it's one thing that my mother got right. And, you know, I would... it goes a long way towards not feeling too better. XRP mooning. Yeah, it's going to the roof, isn't it? I'm twice divorced. I discovered you far too late and not holding out hope of a third. I'm sorry about that. Good women seem hard to find in the West. Well, take a leadership position, man. All radical leftist BLM types, usually when I tell them I'm right, they get more attached. Yeah, you don't ever want to be with someone who can't ever be happy. Maybe you're just like my mother, she's never satisfied. So, yeah, don't be with anybody who can't be satisfied. And I'll get into what happens with women on the left and why they're never satisfied and why they can't be happy and why women tend to drive government spending and all of that. And we're going to get into it all. I don't know how to explain to you that you should care about other people, says Kayla Chadwick. And I don't know how to explain to you that you should care about other people. So one thing you need to understand about women is that things are so obvious to them emotionally that if you don't agree with them, it's just because you haven't understood them. So when a woman says listen, a lot of times she simply means agree. And as long as you understand that, then you can have an honest disagreement with the woman and say, no, I understand, right? So if a woman says to you, I really need you to listen to me, a lot of times what she's saying is, my feelings are so strong and they're so certain that the only conceivable reason that you might not agree with me is you just haven't heard me. And to make sure that you really, really hear a woman is the first step towards de-escalating conflict, right? Because if you're absolutely certain of something and someone's just not listening to you and resisting you and opposing you for reasons that make absolutely no sense, you're just going to get more and more upset. Like if you're in some town you grew up in, you know every street, every corner, every boulevard, and someone's taking a wrong turn and you're late for something, and that you try to explain to them, like, look, you're going the wrong way, turn around, and they simply don't listen, you're going to get more and more annoyed, right? So that's the thing to understand, that women feel that they're right. And their feelings are so absolutely certain that if you try to argue against what the woman is feeling without first truly absorbing and repeating back to her what she said, you're not going to get anywhere. You're not. So you need to listen to her. Listening doesn't mean agreeing. For a lot of women, wanting to be listened to means wanting to be agreed with. That's fine. So but make sure you listen. Fully absorb what she's saying, top to bottom, back to front, and really get it, explain it back to her. Once she feels that you genuinely understand what she's saying, then you can have a disagreement with her. But if you try to disagree without going through the full deep process of listening, it's just going to get more and more tense, and you're going to have a useless fight. And again, a lot of men think, well, if I listen to something without talking back, I must be agreeing with it, and it bothers me, and I don't agree. It's like, but play the long game, so to speak. So look at this title, right? I don't know how to explain to you that you should care about other people, right? It's so obvious that you should care for other people that if you don't agree with her, I have no idea what to say. So for a lot of women, like if you go outside and it's raining and you're with someone and you say, hey, it's raining, and they say, no, it's not, it would be like, I don't really know how to explain that it's raining when it's raining and you're telling me it's not, right? So if you understand that, like for a lot of women, right, emotions are the empiricism of their existence, right? Emotions are the empiricism. And we men, we can look at that and say, well, that's just crazy. It's not crazy. It's perfectly sensible in the right context and absolutely the reason why we're all here, the reason why we're alive, the reason why we evolved and progressed and became the apex predator on the planet. This is due to women's delightful, deep, passionate, and powerful emotionality. And for men to scorn women's emotionality when it's fundamentally the only reason that we're all alive it's foolish and short-sighted and insulting to everyone. I don't know how to reason with women, but that's what I'm here to tell you. This is what I'm here for, okay? First thing you got to do, listen, put your ego aside, put your disagreements aside. Once she feels fully listened to you, then you can begin to give her feedback. But until she feels fully listened to, you simply won't be able to make any headway. So she goes on to say, our disagreement is not merely political, but a fundamental divide on what it means to live in a society. She says, like many Americans, I'm having politics fatigue, or to be more specific, arguing about politics fatigue. I haven't run out of salient points or evidence for my political perspective, but there's a particular stumbling block I keep running into when trying to reach across the proverbial aisle and have those difficult conversations so smugly suggested by think piece after think piece. You know, like the ones where they said, we really, really need to have an honest conversation about race. Oh, here's some facts about IQ. Okay, not that honest a conversation about race. That's not what we're talking about. She says, I don't know how to explain to someone why they should care about other people. All right, so best step is to never argue with a woman. It's just not worth it. No, of course you got to argue with a woman. Of course, you can't be in a relationship and self-censor and self-erase. To that point, no. You're not showing any respect for women by either bullying them or by appeasing them, right? You don't want to be at their feet or at their throat. You just want to negotiate, but that's a little bit of a different thing, right? So she says, what does she say? What does it mean to care about other people? What does it mean to care about other people? Let's say poor people, right? So poor people. There's lots of ways you can care about poor people that really mean something. So you can care about poor people, say, by running a show for 16 years where nobody pays you a penny. They can all call in and talk about their issues, get the benefit of your business experience, your philosophical experience, your self-knowledge experience. You can, as I have, paid for many listeners to go to therapy and get help that way. You can really sit down and talk with people and listen to them. If you know someone who's poor, who's underperforming, then you can sit down and figure out what their barrier is, what their block is, maybe give them some feedback, maybe help them get to a professional who can help them bring out their true potential. Lots of good things you can do for the poor. You can start a business and you can hire some poor people, thus raising their wages from zero to whatever you're paying them, and also, of course, raising the wages of other poor people because you're taking some poor people out of the equation by hiring them yourself, which drives up the wages to other people. You can tell poor people about Bitcoin. You can buy them, some Satoshi amount and give it to them. You can do lots of things to help poor people. You can help people raise their income by suggesting that moms stay home with their kids, breastfeed them more, play with them more, cuddle with them more, have a great relationship with them, and that way people don't become broke by divorce and child welfare bills. When it comes, or teen ranch from hell bills when the kids are teenagers and so on, right? So she says, personally, I'm happy to pay an extra 4.3% for my fast food burger if it means the person making it for me can afford to feed their own family. See, that is pretty interesting, right? That is pretty interesting. So let's look at that sentence, right? Personally, I'm happy to pay an extra 4.3% for my fast food burger if it means the person making it for me can afford to feed their own family. If you aren't willing to fork over an extra 17 cents for a Big Mac, you're a fundamentally different person than I am. So that is very interesting. And that, you got to understand, this is from a female perspective. And again, this is not only women, we're just talking averages here. So female perspective, what does it mean? Are you saying, this is her incomprehension, and you got to view it from this, right? You got to view it from this side. If you want to help people to get more towards reason and evidence, right, you got to help them, which means you got to listen to where they're starting from, right? So if somebody says to this woman, I would rather keep my 17 cents so that the person making it for me cannot afford to feed their own family, right? Let's forget it's a plural to, it's a singular to plural, the person and their own family, whatever, it's fine. So from a perspective of just in the moment, right, a tiny, tiny little time slice, right? So there used to be reporting that was based upon principles, ideas, arguments, facts, data. Now they can't just tell you the statistics of poverty. They have to find a poor person and talk to that person ad infinitum or ad nauseum, because women will connect by looking eyeball to eyeball. Women will connect by empathizing with somebody that they can see at the other end of the camera. And this is why you see these articles that start, you know, so-and-so woke up in a cold sweat. She couldn't afford to pay her bills. And she lived in a small rundown apartment in the Upper East Side. And she, you know, she had to trade in her car because she couldn't afford the insurance. And she gets up and she has to use fish oil as a face cream because whatever, right? And she's at risk of bursting into flames or being eaten by a shark, tornado style, Sharknado style, right? So if you say to women abstract stuff, they won't connect with it. Think of some physicist showing you a bunch of equations, or an engineer showing you a bunch of equations or blueprints. And if you're not an engineer or a physicist, you can't connect to that stuff. It's just a bunch of squiggles for you. So when you bring a lot of data and charts and so on, for women, it's like, yeah, but people, right? They need eyeball-to-eyeball contact. They need to understand things in terms of something in the moment, something right in front of them, and a problem that can be solved that way. So, of course, If you say to a woman, I want to keep my 17 cents so that someone can't afford to feed their own family, right? That makes no sense to a woman, right? And listen, if this was the case, you know, if you aren't willing to fork over an extra 17 cents for a Big Mac so that some guy can, man or woman, can afford to feed their own family, then you're a fundamentally different person than I am. Now, you understand, there's no arguments here. I mean, there's a little bit of nonsense debt, right? And just so you know, like this is from a July 27th, 2015 study. Raising wages to $15 an hour for limited service restaurant employees would raise prices 4.3%. And I guess the 4.3% on a Big Mac is 17 cents. All right. Okay. So whether that is true or not, right? But how could you possibly want to hold on to 17 cents rather than have someone feed their own family, right? Now, again, you may rebel and yeah, I get all of that. But you got to understand where she's coming from. And you have to agree, of course, that it's good when people can afford to feed their own families. Of course it is. I would love for people to be able to feed their own families. So if you agree with the goal, right, like if a woman feels that, or a socialist, I kind of repeat myself there, but if a woman feels that you agree with the goal, like I am desperate for people to be able to afford to feed their own family on simple grounds of ethics, humanitarianism, compassion, and also, you know, I don't want them roaming around the neighborhood stealing stuff because they got to feed their own family, right? So, yes, of course we want workers to feed their own family. Absolutely no question. I would love to have a society where everyone could afford to feed their own family, right? Wonderful. Okay. The question is, paying an extra 17 cents for a Big Mac, is that going to be the way that someone can afford to feed their own family, right? So yes, there's a path that people take in life. They end up being unable to feed their own family. That's a bad thing, and we should try to prevent that rather than wallpaper it over with the extra 17 cents, right? Because this person, she's on the left, right? Because she says reach across the aisle, right? So she's on the left, so you would have to say, of course, so if whatever, a Big Mac, so if McDonald's charged an extra 17 cents, do you really think that all that money would go directly into workers' wages, or would the managers and the executives pay themselves a big bonus, maybe give a little bit extra, would they open more stores, whatever, right? How do you know the extra 17 cents is actually going to go to the person, right? Now, the other thing, too, is can't you just give them some extra money? It's one thing to do, right? And the other thing, too, is that, you know, how many people working minimum wage are trying to feed a family, right? So I'm reading this Cheryl Atkinson book. It's very, very good, called Slanted. And she talks about when she was a reporter, she was given a task to find a family that was living on minimum wage and trying to raise children and interview those people and just, you know, get the heartstrings tugging and the, we can't afford TV or whatever it is, right? So she was given this mission, try and find, you know, find a family living on minimum wage. So she went to a bunch of poverty advocacy groups, right? And she said, you know, I need to interview people who are trying to raise a family on minimum wage, right? Quick question. How many families did she find with two working parents trying to feed their kids on minimum wage? How many? Just out of question. I mean, those of us who know about the welfare state know the answer to this, but, you know, what do you have out there? How many? Yeah, that's right. She couldn't find a single one. She could not find a single family where two people were working minimum wage. So then she's like, okay, give me a family with one person working minimum wage. And they're like, yeah, we'll get right back to you. And they couldn't find even one person with one family. Okay, give me a single parent trying to raise kids on minimum wage. Couldn't find anything. Okay, just give me anyone trying to live on minimum wage. Couldn't find it. She finally did find one guy who was old and taking a minimum wage job cleaning the park because he was bored and wanted something to do and didn't want much responsibility. And, of course, he also had Social Security, I assume, so he didn't need the money, but it was just, right, so zero. So What kind of problem are you trying to solve? Is it a big problem that there are people making minimum wage trying to feed their own family? And if you give the extra 17 cents, will it actually go to those people? The other thing, of course, is that if you pay extra for everything, then everything costs more for the poor people, right? Everything costs more for the poor people. So if you raise the prices of everything, then you give higher, like you give minimum wage or $15 an hour, whatever it is, for the people who are working in the fast food places. But because the prices of everything has been raised 4.5%, then they have less purchasing power, right? So it doesn't really solve that problem. And you always have to reiterate that you absolutely want people to be able to feed their own families. Like, of course you do. And of course, there's also food banks and all of that, right? She also, by the way, in this book, she has a story where there was a, I think it was in New York, coffee. She was in New York, the governor decided to give a bunch of welfare people money out of the blue to supposedly buy their kids school supplies. But they didn't really say this ahead of time, didn't say what it was for, but the money just dumped into the bank accounts of the people on welfare. They just got hundreds of thousands or thousands of dollars. And what happened was, of course, the vast majority of that, though not all, right? Some of it was spent on school supplies, but most of it was spent on, you know, the usual suspects, which I saw when I was working up north in Ontario. You'd have a post office, a beer store, and a convenience store. So you go to the post office back then, you would cash your welfare check. You would then go to the beer store, pick up some beer. You'd go to the convenience store, pick up some smokes, and then you'd head home, right? And anyway, so she went out and filmed all this stuff and interviewed a whole bunch of people and you know, the stores, the clerks saying, oh, this is terrible. I don't even know. They would go and buy big screen TVs and so on. And eventually she was not able to air the story. Does anyone want to guess why she was not able to air the story? Because here, you know, here's a situation where people didn't get an extra 17 cents per Big Mac or 4%. They got hundreds or thousands of dollars dumped into their bank account, which you think would be a good thing, right? I mean, that would be helpful. They would, you know, but why couldn't they? Why couldn't they go forward with the story? Why did the story get killed? Anyone know? Anyone want to guess? Because anyone? because when they filmed the ATM situation and the people on welfare were lining up to get their money, and the ATMs are running out of cash. No, the reason that they couldn't air the story was all of the people were black. Now, she argued, she said, yeah, but the social workers were black, and I interviewed a black family that did spend the money on school supplies, and no, they didn't, but they can't, right? Because they can't show that kind of stuff, because it goes against the victimized narrative ad infinitum, right? So the question is, why is somebody trying to feed a family while working at McDonald's? Let's say that this does occur, right? Like, why would somebody be wanting to, why? First of all, if you work at McDonald's, pretty sure you could take home some free food. So, you know, not all the food at McDonald's is bad. They used to have, until COVID, they had good salads and wraps. They still have the wraps, I think. But, so you can afford to feed the family. Like when I worked two places. Actually, taught me a lot about unionization. I worked at Pizza Hut and then I worked at Swiss Chalet. Now, Pizza Hut, I could get free food whenever I wanted, which was great. Their fettuccine alfredo was fantastic, and so was their hot chocolate, by the way. And I love pizza. Pizza Hut pizza is the best. But I didn't have to pay for my own uniform. I got all the free food I wanted, and it was not unionized. And then when I went to work at Swiss Chalet, I had to pay for my uniform, I had to pay for my meals, and I had to pay 6 or 7 or 8%, I can't remember exactly what it was, towards the union, and I got a much worse deal than when I was at Pizza Hut. But yeah, it's pretty sad. So yeah, so how is it that you're trying to feed a family and you're working minimum wage? This almost never happens, because of course, if you have a family, and this is why, they couldn't, and this is why nobody was trying to raise kids working at McDonald's or minimum wage jobs, because they get much more money on welfare. I did a show about this years ago called The Welfare Trap, where it was a single woman with two kids who was on welfare would have to earn the equivalent of $62,000 a year just to break even, like just to make enough money to pay for all the benefits she got for free. So in other words, she would go to some fairly demanding job at $62,000 a year and effectively be taxed at a rate of 100%. 100% tax rate. And that's the problem with poverty, is that you want to be generous to the poor people, but you don't want to put them in a situation where it becomes profitable to be irresponsible, right? I mean, you want to help single moms, but you don't want to make it so that it becomes profitable to have kids without a dad around, right? Because then that's a problem, right? So that's what she says. She says, I'm perfectly content to pay taxes that go towards public schools, even though I'm childless and intend to stay that way, because all children deserve a quality, free education. If this seems unfair or unreasonable to you, we are never going to see eye to eye, right? So what do you do? What do you say? Well, it's not, no, it's not $62,000 a year for doing jack shit. It's $62,000 a year for making sure children grow up without a father. Particularly bad for black kids, of course, right? So she says, I'm perfectly content to pay taxes that go towards public schools, even though I'm childless and intend to stay that way, because all children deserve a quality, free education. Well, you know, it's funny, too, because all of the immigrants coming in to do manual labor, you know, that there used to be a huge pool of people to do manual labor when I was younger. In fact, I was one of them. They're called teenagers, and they're actually already in the country. You don't need to bring people in to bring all of this stuff, right? McDonald's throws everything away and locks the dumpsters. Is that right? No, a girl on welfare makes the equivalent of $62,000 a year. In other words, she'd have to make $62,000 a year. It's higher now. This was 5 or 6 years ago I did this presentation. But she would have to earn the equivalent of $62,000 a year in order to get the equivalent of the welfare benefits. So she says all children deserve a quality, free education. Now, let me just scroll back up here. She is a contributor and video editor. So all children deserve a quality, free education, in which case I would first ask her why she didn't become a teacher and teach children for free. You said my fried got fired. You mean my friend got fired for eating two McNuggets after closing? Is that right? Yeah, yeah. So all children deserve a quality, free education. Now, the word deserve here is kind of confusing or whatever it is, right? But so she believes that her taxes give all children a quality, free education. Now, she means, of course, free to the children. I get all of that. But when she says, I'm content to pay taxes because children deserve a free education. Now, the engineering part of me, the rational part of me says that the first thing you want to do is nitpick with the woman and say, well, how can it be free if you have to pay taxes? And she's like, oh, don't be such a nitpicker. I get it. But it's free to the parents, blah, blah, blah. Right. So you could nitpick and say, well, why pay taxes? Can't be free, blah, blah, blah. But don't. So you say all children. So I would love nothing more in the world than children getting a quality free education. Or let's just say nothing's free, right? You understand? I think you got to pay taxes for it. But of course, the goal is to get a quality education, right? The quality education. Now, how do you know that government schools are the very best way to provide education, right? And you can point out, you know, all the statistics that as the amount of spending on students has gone up, student performance and outcomes has gone down. There's a huge amount of violence and sexual abuse and bullying and fear and all of that that's going on in schools. You've got, you know, some of the schools in the inner cities in Baltimore and Chicago have like zero students proficient in math and English and so on. So the disagreement is what you get. The disagreement is not in the goal. I want people to afford to feed their own family. Absolutely. I want people to get quality education. Of course, I'm trying to educate people here tonight, right? So of course I want. So agreeing on the goal, right? So if this seems unfair or unreasonable to you, we're never going to see eye to eye. So somebody said, welfare is addicting. I worked as a psychologist for a public healthcare unit where I live, saw people saying they wanted their son in prison. Oh, is that because they get additional benefits? This is another thing that drives the drugging of children, is if you get your child diagnosed with a mental illness, you get massive social security benefits, disability benefits, and yeah, it's pretty wild. It's terrible. So, and here's the other thing too. So you put these two paragraphs together, and what you do is you try to knit things together into a cohesive worldview, right? Because my question would be to this woman, look,
I want people to be able to feed their own family, and I want quality education. So after 12 years of quality education, how is it possible that somebody is only worth a couple of bucks an hour? Right? I mean, they've been educated for 12 years. 12 years can make you a brain surgeon when you're 18, right? So how is it, if people are getting a free, like a quality education, like they learn job skills, social skills, economic skills, like they get a quality education, how is it that you have to pay an extra 17 cents so they can afford to feed their own family if they're actually getting a quality education? Because the people who are working at McDonald's mostly are adults. I mean, certainly they're adults if they're feeding their own family, right? Not a lot of 13-year-olds trying to feed their own family. So how is it after 12 years of quality education, they're worth almost nothing in the marketplace, right? So again, these are just sort of interesting questions, right? She says, if I have to pay a little more with each paycheck to ensure my fellow Americans can access healthcare, sign me up. Poverty should not be a death sentence in the richest country in the world. If you're okay with thousands of people dying of treatable diseases just so the wealthiest among us can hoard still more wealth, there is a divide between our worldviews that can never be bridged. All right? Right. Right. So, now, again, part of me is would immediately jump in to say things like, well, they don't hoard their wealth, they invest it and create jobs, which raises the wages for everyone so they can afford healthcare, that government healthcare has been associated with lower health outcomes, worse health outcomes than not getting healthcare at all, right? In fact, Medicare outcomes have been worse than people who don't get any kind of healthcare at all. And so part of me wants to start in with the facts, but no, you have to understand and accept that, yes, of course poverty should not be a death sentence. Of course poverty should not be a death sentence. Absolutely. Of course people should get access to healthcare. Absolutely. Wouldn't you like a society with that? Absolutely. Absolutely. So you have to absorb that, you know, it's like the old video of the fat guy with the cannon going in. You got to absorb that information, man. Yes, I get it. We agree completely. Now, I'm surprised that you became a video editor rather than a doctor and gave away your stuff for free, but, you know, whatever. Again, that might be a bit nitpicky, right? So, agree with the purpose. Yeah, absolutely. So we're in agreement. I want healthcare to be as cheap, as available, as effective, as accessible, as humanly possible. We both agree with that. Like, we both want to get to Vegas. You're saying we should take this route. I'm saying we should take this route. Now, again, you might want to get in the ethics after it all, like the initiation of force and taxation is theft and blah, blah, blah. But if you say, like, who would be okay with thousands of people dying of treatable diseases just so the wealthiest among us can hoard still more wealth? Right. Now, of course, the other thing I would say is, since you're childless, for you having a reduction in income, it really only affects you, right? So you say, oh, I have to pay a little more. I got to pay 17 cents for my burger. I got to pay my taxes for schools. I got to pay for healthcare. It's like, okay, but that you're making decisions for yourself. And I think that's fine. You can choose if you want to have less income. But if you're a parent, you don't have as much choice when it comes to voluntarily reducing your income, because you got to pay for your kids. They should have something to do with it, right? So it seems kind of selfish to say, well, I'm willing to pay less and I'm only funding for myself, and say, well, but parents should also pay less, even though the children will end up with less, fewer resources through that way, right? But sure, if you're okay hoarding wealth and so thousands of people are dead, and so, for, you know, there's an old saying comes out of Stalin, right? A million deaths is a tragedy. A million deaths is a statistic. An individual death is a tragedy, right? So men, we have a certain cold-hearted view of the world. Why? Because we compete for resources, which means there's winners and there are losers. And our tribes, our societies are way better off when we have winners and we have losers. And losers doesn't mean that they're existentially a loser. It just means, like, the music industry is better off when the people who write better music and sing better and play better instruments are the ones who get the recording contracts, right? So men we win and we lose because we're in competition for the women. Now, women don't have that same cold-blooded competitive win-lose things for reasons I'll get into later. So for you, you think of thousands of people dying of treatable diseases. If you're a man, you might say, okay, gosh, that's, you know, that's bad. I will pay a certain amount for that, but not too much. Because, you know, 70% of diseases are lifestyle related. In other words, you kind of choose to get ill. People smoke, they drink too much, they're lonely, which is like 15 cigarettes a day. They're, you know, they don't take care of their health. They don't eat well, they don't exercise. So, you know, sorry, but, you know, I'm not going to, like, I eat well, I exercise a lot, and I don't really want all my money going to people who are not taking care of their health, because that's not productive. That's a giant waste of resources. Oh, but they're going to die. So for you, as a man, there's like this abstract thing about society. But for women, what they think of is they see those thousands of people, you know, in the bed, coughing, the blotchy spots, and they're dying, and people are crying, and there are flowers, and there's a funeral, and there's music, and somebody plays All By Myself, and people cry, and then there's food, and you got to bring lasagnas over to the survivors. And like, they have this whole movie of the week playing through the thousands of people dying. For men, it's like, yeah, you know, there's a cost benefit, but we view things kind of in an abstract fashion, which has its value. Women view things like that's a conveyor belt of thousands of people dying, and it hurts them like they're holding that person's hand as they die. You know, like it hits them just solid in the feels. And it's a beautiful thing. Like it's a beautiful thing. If you've ever been in a hospital and you see how you're treated by the doctors, who are usually male, versus the nurses, who are usually female, it's a beautiful thing. Let's not diss it. Let's not be negative about it. So, I'm not going to sing that by myself at the moment. But so, yeah, my first job, I got paid $2.45 an hour. So, there's that. And yeah, they're kind of humiliating. There's this girl I wanted to impress in high school. No, junior high school. I was in junior high. I think I was 13 at the time. And no, that was my second job. My first job was working in a bookstore. It was great because they would rip the covers off the book and give me the books for free. I just went home with like half a dozen books every week and read like crazy, and it was fantastic. And the job I had, this was at a convenience store called Essentials in the Don Mills Mall when it was still a mall. And it was a school I was trying to impress, and she came into the store while I was having to scrape gum off the floor, and I was like, oh, this is not an alpha moment, man. This is not. My granddad always said that Jamaican nurses were the best. It's like that line out of City Slickers with Billy Crystal, right? So for the women, yeah, thousands of people dying of treatable diseases. So some guy, you know, like I watched the Paris Hilton documentary, and I may do something on it because it was actually quite brave. It's had me sort of think about things that I should confess about my history, which nobody's ever heard of before. So, hey, Steph, we love you from Australia. Love you back. Thank you so much for coming by. So, this empathy, this sensitivity, it's a beautiful thing in the moment, in the world. I remember back when you could play tennis. I'm a go-for-everything tennis player. you know, if I have to hit it pool cue style with the base of my racket handle just to get it back, I go for everything. Because, you know, I hate to I hate to lose, I hate to miss. And I was going backwards, and I had to do a real twist to get the ball back, and I fell on my ass and rolled on my back. And my wife, like, got moved, and she was like almost in tears, are you okay, and all of that. And whereas I'm like, okay, I'm a little sore, but I'm fine, I'll be fine, you know. But she right, and it's beautiful, it's beautiful, this aspect of women, right? And love it and treasure it, but it needs to be managed. Like some of the abstract stuff that men can do around, well, you know, they're enemies of the revolution, so put them all in concentration camps, we don't have any empathy with regards to that, can be really bad, right? So how do you know? How do you know that the more money that you're being put into is actually going to go to getting healthcare and not starting wars, right? I mean, it could be anything. So poverty should not be a death sentence in the richest country in the world. It's a very powerful statement, right? Very powerful statement. Now, wealth has to be generated in order to be transferred. And wealthy people, what do they don't just stick their money under a mattress. They can't because of inflation, right? So they invest, they buy, and so on. But of course, I completely understand it. In the Paris Hilton documentary, she's got these roomfuls of shoes, right? And she says, like, I just like sitting around in track pants and I don't wear these shoes. I've never been seen in the same outfit twice. I keep the stuff. I don't use it. Nobody organizes. It just sits here rotting in a cupboard, basically, right? And, so I understand that another pair of shoes sitting in Paris Hilton's closet is not that important relative to somebody getting a treatable disease cured or something like that. So, yes, I agree. But there's a lot of corruption. When you give money to the government, you have no guarantee it's going to go for the right purposes, for the right reasons. There's a lot of theft. There's a lot of fraud. And what's wrong with charity? What's wrong with charity? Right? Shouldn't it be voluntary? Shouldn't it be voluntary? So she says, I don't know how to convince someone how to experience the basic human emotion of empathy. I cannot have one more conversation with someone who is content to see millions of people suffer needlessly in exchange for a tax cut that statistically they'll never see. Do you make anywhere close to the median American salary? Less? Congrats, this tax break is not for you. So she's obviously, so this is a bit of a, it's a tell, right? This is kind of a tell, right? Do you make anywhere close to the median American salary? So I'm going to assume that she doesn't make much money. Right, she doesn't make much money, so this is largely theoretical. Right, this is like, I'm happy to pay more and this and that. The other is like, well, but you're not, because women, on the whole, take hundreds of thousands of dollars a year more out of the government than they put in. Men, of course, put hundreds of thousands of dollars more into the government than they take out. So she's not really paying much of this stuff, because she's getting far more benefits than she's paying for, right? So pointing that out is a bit volatile, but nonetheless, it's still kind of important, right? So she's saying she doesn't make much money, okay? Well, then everything she's talking about is like other people they're going to pay. She's not getting her taxes raised. She says, I cannot have political debates with these people. Our disagreement is not merely political, but a fundamental divide on what it means to live in a society, how to be a good person, and why any of that matters. All right, so here's the thing, right? She thinks that the government is a society, right? She thinks that the government is a charity. She thinks that the government is a friend. She thinks that the government is a parent. She thinks that the government is the society. And the government is the opposite of the society. The society is the sum choice of people's voluntary options, right? It's the sum total of people's voluntary choices. Government is exactly what people don't want to do because they have to be forced to do it, right? So it is economic, right? The free market is economic dating. Government is economic rape, right? So fundamental divide. So she thinks that a society means having people point guns at you, take money, keep most of it for themselves, and then bribe the rest of everyone else to remain dependent on the government. She thinks that's the society. Okay, she says there are all kinds of practical self-serving reasons to raise the minimum wage. Fairly compensated workers typically do better work. Okay. So if she can... and this is part of the vanity. Now, we're all susceptible to this vanity. Maybe women a little bit more than men, but all susceptible to this vanity, right? So the vanity is that I'm smarter than the business leaders at McDonald's. I'm smarter than the business leaders at McDonald's. Because, you know, fairly compensated workers typically do better work. Now, what does that mean? It means, so I would say, look, if you have a better business idea than the people who run McDonald's, that's a pretty good thing, isn't it? That's a pretty good thing. Now, the idea that fairly compensated workers typically do better work is kind of the cause and effect thing that a lot of people have trouble with in economics. It's like, no. Because if you're paying people more, you can demand better workers. It's not that fairly compensated workers typically do better work. Like you take someone with an IQ of 85 and you double their salary and suddenly they've got an IQ of 110. It's not how it works. That if you pay people more, you can be more picky, be more choosy. You can have higher standards and you can get better people. Yeah, somebody pointed out fairly compensated workers do better work, or maybe they are compensated more because they do better work. Yeah, of course. Of course. Of course. So, but I would say, look, I mean, if you're smarter than the people who run McDonald's, then you should start a restaurant and make a fortune and pay people better and so on, right? But again, it's always other people who've got to do. Like, you wanna thump your chest and say, oh, I'm a good person, I care about people getting health care, and I want kids to get educated. And it's like, well, why don't you go out and do it then, right? I mean, I want people to be more philosophical, so I go and put my ass and neck on the line every day, sometimes my balls, it feels like, too, because I want people to be educated in philosophy. I don't just sit there and say, well, it would be really great if the government funded philosophical programs and educated people in philosophy. It's like, go out and do it. I mean, all the time that she spent writing this article, she could have been out there helping poor people. Crazy. She says, practical self-serving reasons. Fund public schools. Everyone's safer when the general public can read and use critical thinking. Sorry, I would never do this to her face. It strikes me as enormously funny. So this woman, educated in government schools, who doesn't have a scrap of critical thinking to her name, genuinely believes that public schools teach critical thinking. She thinks you give money to the government and paradise results, right? And she's a perfect example of how, well, you're not safer with this tax-hungry woman around, right? Because your pocketbook isn't safe. It's the irony, right? It's like the irony in the Paris Hilton, and spoiler, skip ahead for a sec if you haven't seen it, Paris Hilton's documentary. She from the age of 13 to 15, she turned into a club nut, right? She went clubbing and nightclubs and so on, not seals, and nightclubs. And her parents were so terrified of her getting, like, kidnapped that they actually had her kidnapped. They literally had her kidnapped, dragged from a bed in the middle of the night, taken to one of these absolutely brutal, brutal teen re-education gulags. And she was beaten, and she was put in solitary confinement. She was incredibly traumatized, and she was there for years, various schools. Unbelievably brutal. We're so afraid of you getting kidnapped, we're going to make sure you get kidnapped. It's crazy. Anyway. So she says, and make sure every American can access healthcare. Outbreaks of preventable diseases are generally undesirable. And that's the snarkiness, right? Like, it's so obvious. Because, you know, without the government, who the hell is going to develop gain of function research on bat coronaviruses? I mean, free market's not going to do that. There's no benefit to the free market doing that. Without the government, who's going to fund this stuff in North Carolina and then ship it over to Wuhan? Without the government, who's going to call Trump racist for trying to close the borders from a pandemic from China? Come on. But if making sure, and also the vast majority of improvements in health have to do with sanitation and exercise and particularly better food and better water and so on, doesn't have much to do actually with healthcare as a whole. All right. But she says, but if making sure your fellow citizens can afford to eat, get an education, and go to the doctor isn't enough of a reason to fund these things, I have nothing left to say to you. And this is the kind of critical thinking that she doesn't have, which is, well, the government does X, and if the government doesn't do X, X won't get done. Which is like saying, well, the slaves pick the cotton, so if there's no slavery, the cotton won't get picked, and we'll all freeze to death in the winter. Anyway, I'm for universal health care. Right, so you're a gangster, right? You're a thug because you want guns and bullets to achieve your utopia. Yeah, a very deeply dangerous human being, afraid to say. I can't debate, she says, I can't debate someone into caring about what happens to their fellow human beings. The fact that such detached cruelty is so normalized in a certain party's political discourse is at once infuriating and terrifying. Yeah. She can't debate, and she's hyper-emotional. And by the way, did you know statistically that the more emotional a woman is, the more likely she is to end up with a psychopath as a boyfriend, husband, lover, whatever, right? So she's infuriated. She's terrified. She can't debate, and yet she believes that schools teach critical thinking. So not caring about what happens to their fellow human beings. So I care enormously what happens to my fellow human beings, which is why I don't want guns pointed at them to follow this woman's virtue signaling. I don't want guns pointed at people. I don't want their property taken. by force. And here's the thing too, right? Like, does she not care about the children? I mean, oh, I care about the children. But doesn't she, you know, the children are born into like $1 million at least of debt, right? Because of all of this funding, right? So where is the talk about, well, we care about the children, and the children didn't vote for any of this. They're not responsible for the society that they're born into, right? So doesn't she care about the children? There's nothing in here about how to pay off the debt, right? Because, you see, paying off the debt would require her to make difficult decisions and prioritize something, as opposed to, well, I'm willing to theoretically pay money I'll never actually have to pay in order to achieve some imaginary good in society. What's the matter with you? Well, where is her concern for the children born into MASH? Where's her concern about the debt, right? Somebody says, Steph, do you feel we in the West are living in a dystopian nightmare? Oh, God, no. Absolutely not. No. You see, you can wake up from a nightmare. We're stuck with this shit. Don't insult nightmares by comparing them to the modern West. And also, you're somewhat responsible for your own nightmares due to self-knowledge. She goes on to say, the I've got mine, so screw you attitude has been oozing from the American right wing for decades, but this gleeful exuberance in pushing legislation that will immediately hurt the most vulnerable among us is chilling. Yeah. Okay, so vulnerable is a word. I want to explain this word, and I've touched on this before, so I'll do it briefly here. But this is a word important to understand, right? Vulnerable. Why are women so egalitarian? Why are women so against? Why is it freedom of opportunity has to be scrapped for equality of outcome? Right, equality of opportunity has to be scrapped for equality of outcome. Okay, first thing you got to always remember when you're dealing with women, they are programmed for 0 to 7 years of age. They're programmed for 0 to 7 years of age. Now, and this is understood by many cultures, right? I think certain Jewish sects is like if there's a divorce, the woman gets the kids from until they're 7 years old, the man gets them after that, father gets them after that. So you got to understand, and I hate to pull this stay-at-home dad thing, but I've been home for this kind of stuff, so I've really, really seen this in action, right? I've been upfront, up close and personal for this, right? So for a woman, let's say, and women had a whole bunch of kids, whole mess of kids, right, in the past. You know, this like one kid and three cats stuff is going on. It's pretty new, right? So you're a woman, you've got 4 kids, right? And they're all under the age of 6. You can't let one of them compete. You can't let the youngest compete against the eldest. You don't just give them a bunch of food and say to the 3-month-old baby and the 6-year-old boy, well, good luck. Compete for it. Fight for it, right? Winners and losers. She has to make sure things are equal. Or as a friend of mine with 2 very competitive daughters said, where he would say, he would go into an ice cream place and say, I'd like 2 ice creams. And if you have an atomic weigh scale, please use it so that one child doesn't accidentally get 1 more atom of ice cream than the other child, because they'd sit there and measure it. And I did the same thing. I remember my brother and I were up in Scotland. We were thinking of moving to Scotland, not Canada, way back in the day. So we're up in Scotland and we were staying at a place and we got to write in the guest book our comments on where we were staying. And of course, we had to have the same number of letters. It all had to be ferociously equal. And my brother wrote super, and I wrote duper. Because I didn't mind being second. He got the cat. I still remember this. Like, oh my God. Like, it's almost 50 years later, right? And I still remember this. My brother wrote super, and I wrote duper. Super duper. That was it. That's how it, well, you gotta be equal. It's gotta be equal. It's gotta be equal. And this equality thing. When you describe the vulnerable, the marginalized communities, understand that for women, that is like the runt of the litter. It's the kid who's being shortchanged, and she is genetically, biologically, emotionally programmed to redistribute from the older and the more successful and the stronger and the bigger to the younger, the less successful and the smaller and the weaker. And she's entirely right to do that. There's no free market for food for the under 7 set in a household, right? You got to share. You know, if she has twins and one of them is smaller and weaker than the other, then of course she's not going to sit there and say, well, I'm only going to breastfeed the stronger one, or to hell with the weaker one and the younger one, because she can't do that because she's invested so many calories and emotions and everything into growing a baby. She can't just say, well, you know, let's let the weak one fade off and let's make pour our resources into the strong one. She can't do it. Which is why when you see this as vulnerable and marginalized and excluded and like, that's the kid, that's the runt of the litter who's not getting enough food, and women are tortured by that, and they should be in their own family or in their own community, in their own tribe. Of course they should be. Of course they should be. They have to equal things out. You can't be given 50% of the calories to one of the kids. You can't. You have to even it out. And of course, that's to keep the peace as well, because we're all born with that super duper philosophy. You get one word, I get the other. You can have the first word because you're older, but I get the second one. It's got to be the same number of letters, super duper. We all have that philosophy. My brother was supposed to be able to stay up 5 minutes later than I was when I was a kid. And sometimes if I was feeling grumpy, I'd sit in my bed and I'd count to 300. And one time I came out and they were making cookies. Right? So you got, we all know this if we're siblings, right? You got to fight. You got to fight for your portion. You got to fight for your share. And you're constantly scanning to make sure that you get your fair share. And it's the mom who's responsible for equality of outcome. And if there's not equality of outcome, she feels intense anxiety. And she should, and she's right to feel that, you understand? Now, if you can convince women that this section of society or that section of society are marginalized and vulnerable and excluded and they don't have a voice, and then it hooks into their programming for egalitarianism among toddlers. Among toddlers. And that's exactly right. We've all seen it, right? We've all seen it. Go to a park, right? All right, you've had 5 minutes on that swing. Now you give your brother a turn. He's got to have 5 minutes on the swing, right? And then you count to 300, right? Like me, right? Now, this is particularly true. What happens to all of these instincts when women can be talked into not having children? Right? What happens to all of these instincts for radical egalitarianism? Well, they're not applied to their own children, so they become applied to groups in society. Immigrants or blacks or Hispanics or whoever, marginalized, excluded, whatever, right? And so you get this natural, I wouldn't say it's not pathological when it's her own children or her community's children. It's pathological when it's applied to abstract political entities. Sympathy for the underdog. You know, when I was, and I remember this transitioning even when I was a little kid. When I was a little kid, you would go from the hero movies, right? Like the John Wayne hero movies. And then it was all like sympathy for the underdog movies. And that's for women. Women, sympathy for the underdog, man. Sympathy for the underdog. I mean, lusting after the alpha male, but sympathy for the underdog makes perfect sense. It makes absolutely, you understand that for her, these are the kids she's not having. Right? I've got mine, so screw you. Now, if you can imagine a mom with a six-year-old and a one-year-old, and the six-year-old is grabbing food from the one-year-old saying, I got mine, screw you. What's the mom going to do? What would you do as the dad? Of course you'd say, no, you can't have that. Now, let's say that you've got an 8-year-old and a 3-year-old, right? And the 8-year-old, it's Halloween, the 8-year-old comes back with bags of candy, and the 3-year-old, if he even went out at all, has barely anything, right? Well, what are you going to say to the 8-year-old? You got to share. And the 8-year-old's going to resist it, but you're like, come on, you know, you were 3 once, we gave you candy, and, you know, this is your brother and sister, whatever. You gotta even it out. You got to even it out. And so evening things out is entirely the job of moms with toddlers. Now, the reason they get passed over to their dads is the dads have to start filtering according to excellence to make sure that society's resources are best used, right? So that the best hunter gets the bow, right? Because he's the one who's going to bring down the food, which everybody's got to eat or you starve, right? So, no, it's not socialist. So people say all moms are socialist, hence why dads are needed as the authority, right? So, no, it's not socialist if it's your family. It's not socialist if they're toddlers. It is socialist when you mistake the government for the society for the family, and you mistake actual grown adults for toddlers. But they're vulnerable. Then you see this all the time, right? You see this all the time. And so look at these people's examples, right? Look at this woman's examples, and you'll see exactly what I mean, and you'll see it everywhere. This is why, this is going to be one of your things, right? What is she talking about? Feed children. I'm happy to pay an extra 4.3% of my fast food burger personally making them feed their own family. Feeding children. Boom. Number one. Well, of course you have to be egalitarian when it comes to feeding children, right? Of course, right? Educating children. What's the second one? Quality free education. Yeah, so of course the primary job for moms was to educate the children, to transmit the cultural values and continuity of civilization. Well, that's just why when you convince, it is cultural genocide when you convince women to not have children, or at least to have children and dump them in daycare, because that's it for your entire cultural continuity, right? I mean, can you imagine? I mean, the Jewish religion has been running for, 5,000 plus years, and, they're not putting their kids in daycare because they got to stay home and teach the kids the values, right? So what has she got? Feed your own family, educate the children, and make sure people don't get sick. Healthcare. So this woman doesn't even have a clue that she's talking about everything that she would be doing with children, making sure that they're educated, making sure that they have enough to eat, making sure that they don't get sick, and taking care of them if they were sick. My mom, as I said before, fantastic when I was ill. She was terrible as an employee, but she was great when I was ill. She was really, really good. So you understand, all that she's talking about is exactly what she would be doing if she had her own children. Education, healthcare, food. And this is why women talk about this stuff and is much less about shelter, because shelter is generally provided by the man, right? So, I've got mine, so screw you. Well, that's kind of a male thing, right? Which is, look, I'm winning. Look, you guys are watching me rather than someone else, right? So I'm glad to be winning, because if nobody was watching me, it would be a bit of an odd show, I suppose, right? So there's a pivot, right? So when kids are young and they're singing, what do the moms say? Oh, it's lovely. Oh, even if it's not, right? And then at some point, and you can see this in the American Idol stuff, where the men are just blunt and harsh, and the women are all like, well, sweetie, this kind of stuff, right? I don't know. So, if a kid's drawing a picture, 5-year-old draws a picture, what does the mom say? Oh, it's beautiful. I love it. I'm putting it up on the fridge. Wonderful. That's exactly what she should be doing. Be encouraging. Open things up, right? But if the 15-year-old is drawing a crappy picture, what's the dad going to say? That's not very good, right? Yay, positive stuff, right? Positive stuff. You threw a ball, yay, you caught a ball, yay. This is very good stuff. It's exactly what women should be doing and moms should be doing. But the dads who coach Little League, well, you got to be good at hitting the ball, and you got to be good at catching the ball, and you got to be good at throwing the ball. Otherwise, you can't win. So then you start excluding. Now, for women, it's kind of tough, because it's tough for them to peel their hearts away from that early childhood stuff where you've got to encourage everything and everything has to be completely egalitarian. Has to be, or we don't survive. Has to be, or we don't survive. Because if you invest huge amounts of time, energy, and calories and then ignore the egalitarian requirements of toddlers, the toddler's going to get sick or hungry or die or whatever, wander off. So, but then the men have to start sorting by meritocracy, by talent. Like some little kid banging away on the xylophone, the mom's like, yay, great song, right? You try that to get a recording contract, no luck, because all the men are going to be like, no, that sucks, sorry, it's not for you, man. No. Right, so women are the eternal yes, and men are the nope. Women are enthusiasts and men are skeptics. Women encourage and men discourage. Right, so we want women to encourage so that the most number of people try to do the most number of things, and you want men to discourage so that only the very best end up in control of the resources so that you maximize. Like, it's one thing to, yay, great picture. It's another thing to say, well, even if you're good or bad with a spear, everybody gets a spear and runs into battle. It's like, that's how to lose a battle. You want the guys who are the very best with the spears to get the spears, right? Puh, right?